Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Hamas responded tonight. We're reviewing that response now, and I'll be discussing it with the government of Israel tomorrow. There's still a lot of work to be done, but we continue to believe that an agreement is possible and indeed essential.
Hamas puts forward a deal to end Israel's assault on Gaza. The plan is a response to a U.S.-backed Israeli deal for a temporary ceasefire. We'll get the latest with former Israeli negotiator Daniel Levy. Then, Netanyahu's war on truth.
From the immediate moment after the October 7th attacks, Israel has unleashed a sustained information warfare campaign to dehumanize Palestinians. And this campaign has included lies. It's flooded the zone with misinformation, unverified allegations. And Israel has gotten the White House to launder these lies. And the purpose was to justify the unjustifiable, a scorched earth campaign against the population of Gaza.
We'll speak with investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill about Israel's propaganda campaign to dehumanize Palestinians. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. A federal appeals court has unanimously rejected Donald Trump's claim that he's immune from federal prosecution for his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. In its ruling, the three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit wrote, quote, "We cannot accept former President Trump's claim that a president has unbounded authority to commit crimes that would neutralize the most fundamental check on executive power, the recognition and implementation of election results." The judges went on to write, quote, "Nor can we sanction his apparent contention that the executive has carte blanche to violate the rights of individual citizens to vote and to have their votes count." Trump has vowed to appeal the ruling, possibly to the Supreme Court. During oral arguments last month, Trump's legal team claimed the former president should have full immunity to do anything, even assassinate political opponents. In a chaotic day on Capitol Hill, the Republican effort to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas failed after Republicans fell one vote short. Democratic Congressmember Al Green cast the deciding vote while wearing a hospital gown. Green came to the Capitol directly from a hospital where he was recovering from a recent surgery. Republicans are vowing to hold another impeachment vote on Mayorkas, who they accuse of failing to uphold immigration laws at the U.S.-Mexico border. In a second setback for House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republicans also failed to pass a standalone bill to send $17.6 billion in military assistance to Israel. Meanwhile, in the Senate, a bipartisan $118 billion immigration and foreign aid bill appears to be dead after Republican lawmakers revolted against the very bill they had been pushing for. On Tuesday, President Biden accused Donald Trump of blowing up the plan, which included harsh new border measures as well as new military aid for Ukraine, Israel, and allies in the Pacific.
Now, all indications are this bill won't even move forward to the Senate floor. Why? A simple reason. Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump thinks it's bad for him politically. Therefore, he doesn't even know it helps the country. He's not for it. He'd rather weaponize this issue than actually solve it.
The ACLU has warned the bipartisan deal would have eviscerated longstanding asylum protections and forced the government to summarily expel people from the southern border without due process. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Israel as negotiations continue over a possible truce and hostage deal that could end Israel's assault on Gaza, at least temporarily. On Tuesday, Qatar said Hamas had given a, quote, positive response to a proposed deal, but President Biden described Hamas's response as over the top. In its counteroffer, Hamas proposed a three-phased ceasefire over 135 days where Hamas would release all hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. Hamas is also calling for a permanent ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, demands Israel has so far opposed. As the negotiations continue, the New York Times is reporting Israel now believes a fifth of the hostages held in Gaza may already be dead. The paper cited a confidential Israeli assessment that estimated at least 30 of the remaining 136 hostages captured on October 7th have died. Meanwhile, the United Nations is urging Israel to halt plans for a ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah, warning it will lead to a, quote, large-scale loss of life. Some displaced Palestinians are living in cemeteries in Rafah.
People were forced to come here to this safe place, which is the cemetery among the dead, which is better than living in residential areas where the houses could collapse over our heads. We come here to live among the dead because of fear and horror. I envy the dead people for their current situation. They are dead, but in fact they are alive with God, well provided for. I envy them because they are better than us now. We live every second in horror. Every minute passing, we are in horror, pain, torture, suffering, and confusion because we don't know when the war will end. It's a very painful situation.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz has revealed the Israeli military has begun investigating the actions of its own forces during the October 7th Hamas attack. Part of the probe is focused on Kibbutz Be'eri, where an Israeli brigadier general has admitted that he ordered an Israeli tank commander to fire on a home where Hamas fighters were holding Israelis hostage. Brigadier General Barak Haram told the New York Times that he'd ordered the tank commander to, quote, break in, even at the cost of civilian casualties. Only two of the 15 Israeli hostages survived. We'll have more on this story later in the show. The U.S. Department of Education has opened an investigation into Harvard University after a group of Muslim and Palestinian students filed a federal civil rights complaint alleging the school had failed to protect them from harassment and intimidation. In other education news, two students at Northwestern University in Illinois have been criminally charged after they published a mock version of the school's newspaper. The mock paper included a front-page article accusing Northwestern's administration of being complicit in the genocide of Palestinians. The Intercept reports that the students, who are both black, are being charged under a little-known statute written to prevent the Ku Klux Klan from distributing recruitment materials in newspapers. The students face up to a year in prison and a $2,500 fine. In election news, Nikki Haley lost the non-binding Republican presidential primary in Nevada Tuesday, even though Donald Trump was not even on the ballot. Over 60% of Republican primary voters in Nevada selected a box that said none of these candidates. About 30% of voters picked Haley, the former South Carolina governor who served as Trump's U.N. ambassador. On Thursday, Republicans in Nevada will also hold a caucus. Trump is competing in the caucus, but Haley is not. Meanwhile, Joe Biden easily won Nevada's Democratic primary with about 89% of the vote. In other political news, the chair of the Republican National Committee, Ronna McDaniel, has reportedly agreed to resign after coming under intense pressure from Donald Trump. McDaniel plans to step down after the South Carolina primary. Trump is reportedly pushing for Michael Whatley, the chair of the North Carolina Republican Party, to become the new head of the RNC. Whatley is a prominent election denier who endorsed Trump's false claims about the 2020 election being stolen. In California, at least 9 people have died as the state continues to be pummeled with record-breaking rainfall from a deadly atmospheric river storm. Some areas of Southern California recorded over 13 inches of rain in recent days, triggering mass flooding and hundreds of mudslides. This is the actor and filmmaker Deborah Pewitt speaking in Studio City as a river of water flowed down the street.
We are having these record highs in the summertime and then these incredible storms that we've never had before that they're calling, you know, once every 100-year storms, and we've had 2 of them since August. So that's my belief is, of course, it's climate change.
In Michigan, a jury has convicted Jennifer Crumbly of 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter for a deadly school shooting carried out by her 15-year-old son at Oxford High School in 2021. Prosecutors argued Crumbly had a duty to prevent her son from going on the rampage, which killed 4 students in what was Michigan's deadliest school shooting. This is Mark Keast, assistant prosecuting attorney in Oakland County, speaking during the trial.
Jennifer Crumbly didn't pull the trigger that day, but she is responsible for those deaths. These kids were gunned down inside Oxford High School with this gun. It's a 6-hour, 9mm handgun purchased 4 days before the shooting by James Crumbly, Jennifer's husband and father of the school shooter. This was a purchase celebrated by Jennifer on Instagram. These are her words. This is her post. Mom and son day testing out his new Christmas present. My first time shooting a 9mm. I hit the bullseye.
Jennifer Crumbly's husband is scheduled to go on trial in March. In Pakistan, at least 26 people have died after a pair of bombings in the province of Balochistan ahead of Thursday's general election. Both blasts targeted the electoral offices of candidates. In Senegal, more than 200 opposition politicians and protesters have been arrested in recent days after Senegalese President Macky Sall postponed this month's election. At least one private television channel has had their broadcasting license revoked after they aired footage of protests on Sunday. The government also shut down internet access via mobile data. Opposition protesters have accused Sall of attempting to stage a coup by extending his term in office. Earlier this week, lawmakers voted to postpone the elections until December. Back in the United States, the former head of Honduras's national police pleaded guilty Tuesday to cocaine trafficking charges. Juan Carlos El Tigre Bonilla appeared in a New York City court just days before he was scheduled to go on trial with former Honduran president Juan Orlando Hernandez. Speculation is growing that Bonilla will now testify against Hernandez. The two were extradited to the United States in 2022. Hernandez was arrested in February 2022, less than a month after his presidential term ended. He was a longtime U.S. ally who received backing during his entire 8-year term, despite mounting reports of serious human rights violations and accusations of corruption and involvement with drug smuggling. His brother, Juan Antonio Tony Hernandez, is currently serving a life prison sentence in the U.S. after being convicted in 2019 of smuggling cocaine. In Chile, the death toll from devastating wildfires has increased to over 120, while hundreds of people are still missing. Thousands of homes were charred and entire neighborhoods decimated after the blazes broke out last week in Chile's central coastal hills. The seaside cities of Viña del Mar and Valparaiso have been engulfed with smoke for days, and volunteers continue to search for survivors. These are the deadliest ever wildfires to hit Chile due to record heat. In more news from Chile, former President Sebastián Piñera died Tuesday in a helicopter crash. He first served from 2010 to 2014 and again from 2018 to 2022. Massive protests broke out against Piñera's government in 2019 due to rising inequality, high cost of living, and privatization. He responded by unleashing Chile's police force and military, both of which were accused of severe human rights violations, including beating and torturing demonstrators. Funeral arrangements are being planned for Namibian President Hage Geingob, who died on Sunday at the age of 82. Geingob was a prominent anti-apartheid activist who became Namibia's first prime minister when the former German colony gained independence from apartheid South Africa in 1990. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa described Geingob as, quote, a towering veteran of Namibia's liberation from colonialism and apartheid. And in New York, beloved transgender advocate, author, and actor Cecilia Gentili has died. Gentili migrated from Argentina years ago and dedicated her life fighting for the rights of sex workers, LGBTQ, and immigrant communities. Gentile starred as Miss Orlando in the acclaimed television series Pose. Her debut memoir, Faltas, Letters to Everyone in My Hometown Who Isn't My Rapist, was released in 2022, detailing her life before leaving Argentina. Last year, she began performing in her autobiographical off-Broadway show called Red Ink. Gentile was also the founder of Trans Equity Consulting, an organization that supports trans women of color, sex workers, immigrants, and incarcerated people. A post on her Instagram said Tuesday, quote, "Our beloved Cecilia Gentile passed away this morning to continue watching over us in spirit. Please be gentle with each other and love one another with ferocity." Gentile was 52 years old. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, negotiations are underway as Hamas puts forward a counterproposal to end Israel's assault on Gaza. We'll speak with former Israeli peace negotiator Daniel Levy. Stay with us. پشت دشتا یه تلایی پشت صحرا های خالی خونه ماست اون بر آب اون بر موجای بیتا پشت جنگل پشت اقیا نوس آبی پشت باقا یه گلابی اون ور با خونی ما بای مرجان فرساد. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York, joined by Amy Goodman. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Nermeen. Welcome to all our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Hamas has put forward a detailed plan for a new ceasefire deal aimed at ending Israel's assault on Gaza. The plan is a response to a proposal drawn up 2 weeks ago by the U.S., Israel, Qatar, and Egypt. The Hamas counterproposal, which was introduced late Tuesday night, envisions three phases of 45 days each. In the first phase, Hamas would release all female Israeli hostages, males under 19, and elderly and sick people in exchange for Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. Israel would also withdraw from populated areas in Gaza, cease aerial operations, allow far more aid to enter, and permit Palestinians to return to their homes, including in northern Gaza. The second 45-day phase, to be negotiated during the first, would include the release of all remaining hostages, mostly soldiers, in exchange for more Palestinian prisoners, and Israel would complete its withdrawal from Gaza. In the third phase, the sides would exchange the remains of hostages and prisoners. President Biden commented on Hamas's counterproposal on Tuesday, calling it, quote, a little over the top.
There is some movement. And I don't want to choose my words. There's some movement. There's been a response from there's been a response from the opposition. But from Hamas. But it seems to be a little over the top. We're not sure where it is. There's a continuing negotiation right now.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Israel overnight after meetings on Tuesday in Egypt and Qatar. He will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Isaac Herzog, among others, to discuss Hamas's response to the proposed deal. Blinken will also meet Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas later today. As the negotiations continue, Israel's assault on Gaza is entering its fifth month. Over 27,500 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 67,000 wounded since October 7th. While the vast majority of Gaza's population have been driven from their homes, much of the territory has been destroyed or severely damaged, and a quarter of the population is facing starvation. For more on the ceasefire negotiations, we're joined by Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project and a former Israeli peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Daniel Levy, welcome to Democracy Now! If we could just begin with your assessment of the negotiations, how they've been proceeding so far, and what you anticipate Israel's response might be to the counterproposal offered by Hamas.
Well, we do now have a detailed position that has been put out in the public domain. You referenced that. I think a crucial thing to say about this is that what Hamas have said is that it's not that we can do phase one, move on to phase two, move on to phase three, is that there has to be an agreement up front that this is going to deliver a final ceasefire. Now, we've heard not detailed counterproposals from the Israeli side. We don't have that. What we have heard is Prime Minister Netanyahu making clear that he will not accept a permanent ceasefire. He will not redeploy his troops out of Gaza, and has also been circumspect on what kind of Israeli prisoner exchange would be on the table. That suggests that the parties are still really quite some distance apart, that there's an element of blame game not being attributed with blame, and there's an element of where more could one take the negotiations. I think, you know what I mean, that will be partly dependent on three factors. Firstly, the balance of forces on the battlefield. This has not gone as Israel had anticipated, as Israel had hoped, as Israel's maximalist war claims had set out. Israel is, yes, operating Gaza. We've seen the terrible destruction. You've gone through that, the level of death, of civilian death, of child death, the disease and starvation now. But we are not seeing Hamas's resilience wane. So on the battlefield, that is still something of a stalemate. The second vector is internal pressure. Now, there is internal pressure inside Israel from the families. There are some inside the war cabinet who have said this needs to change direction. The third vector, and here's where we get to the Blinken visit, Nermin. The third vector is, what are the external dynamics of pressure? We have had what South Africa has done at the International Court of Justice, which I think was very significant. What we do not have is an American Secretary of State empowered to use leverage to put on the table a disincentive, a cost structure for Israel to continue this, and therefore I think we're stuck. What you instead have, curiously perhaps, is an attempt to almost do an end run and to tie in post-war plans with the ceasefire. Now, that could be a good thing, right? This didn't begin on October 7th, 4 months ago today. There are root causes that absolutely need to be addressed if Palestinians or Israelis are going to have security in the future. But Blinken seems to be putting on the table some pretty magical thinking, which has partly been set out in articles by Tom Friedman and David Ignatius, and I think are going to cause more problems, and maybe that's something we can touch on.
And Daniel Levy, if you can talk about the role of Qatar, the role of Egypt in these negotiations. Right now, Blinken is meeting with Netanyahu. And what ideally, and you as a negotiator know the significance of negotiations, Blinken needs to say to Netanyahu, while Blinken has continually said he's heartbroken and gut-wrenched over the fatalities in Gaza, what he's continued to do is provide weapons to Israel and run around Congress twice to ensure artillery shells go to them. So whatever he feels or says he is feeling, the significance of what the U.S. is doing in shoring up Netanyahu.
That is crucial, Amy, because some may have heard the president say, well, it seems like the Hamas position is a little too much. Some may consider the provision of 2,000-pound bombs by the U.S. to Israel, after everything we've seen, a little too much. Some may consider that when there is a plausible case for genocide at the International Court of Justice and you're ignoring those provisional measures a little too much. So what we have is a Qatari and Egyptian party, because there are no direct negotiations with Israel, between Israel and Hamas. So you have the mediators from the region who are talking to Hamas. They can try and lean on Hamas. If Hamas does not feel that it has to concede further, it will not. The question is, as you have noted, will the US lean on Israel? Now, it seems that rather than coming and saying there's a cost for you to do this, what Secretary Blinken is attempting to do is say, you know what, I'm going to reward you. You know what I've got in my back pocket? I've got Saudi normalization. Now, the Saudis have poured some cold water on this in a statement that they issued overnight to contradict something that spokesman Kirby said. But Blinken is hoping that this could somehow push a deal over the line. I think this demonstrates, first of all, naivety. We've had normalization with the UAE and others in the past, and it only encouraged Israeli extremism. It's layers and layers of make-believe. The idea that you can have Western-appointed Palestinian technocratic leaders somehow run the Palestinian side with no credibility on their own people. These limited measures against Israeli settlers that the administration took, when the problem is not a few bad apples. The problem is the state structure of occupation and oppression. So it seems that there's another effort here by the administration to say, we can stop ethnic cleansing, we can stop this displacement, but, and here's the one of the big problems, I think, what is on offer is not Palestinian statehood. It's not that anyone is saying Israel will withdraw, the army will be out, you'll have a recognition of a viable state that's actually going to exist with Jerusalem as its capital. Then we can deal with refugees and other things. What is apparently on offer is a little bit of verbiage in exchange for Saudi normalization. And what this is really, Amy, is this is an attempt to re-entrench, to refreeze the existence of a Bantustan and the use of partition as a tool of violence in ensuring a future of apartheid. And I think that's a pernicious thing to offer Palestinians. You can either have ethnic cleansing or apartheid, because what is not on the table is justice or genuine peace. And to be quite honest, if the US administration wants to make a deal with the Saudis to export more arms, maybe have some companies do well over a civilian energy program, as a geopolitical move to try and slow down de-dollarization, don't pretend that this is a peace move to end the horrors in Gaza, because this is a geopolitical maneuver, not a genocide avoidance maneuver.
And what about the role of Qatar and Egypt in this, and how you feel this is going to play out in the midst of these so-called negotiations that are coming close to yet another, Blinken won't use the word ceasefire, he talks about pause. The threat of a ground invasion of Rafah, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have fled, what, something like 2 million Palestinians are there just on the tip of Gaza and the Egyptian border.
Well, as you say, Palestinians have been moved from one location to the other, and then every time the area they're told to move to, that becomes bombed. That's the story with Khan Yunis today. That's the story with Rafah tomorrow. Qatar can and has, and we saw the first pause and we saw releases. So this magical thinking that there's a non-negotiated path to saving the hostages, unfortunately, those numbers are smaller than what was previously talked about. There is a negotiated path. But Qatar and Egypt can only work with what they have from the Israeli side. And if they have something that is woefully falling short of what is needed, because on the Israeli side, there is division, there's an unwillingness to make those hard decisions, they are not going to be able to deliver on the back of that. Now, Egypt has another concern, which is that Israel still hopes and holds a plan for the mass displacement of Palestinians in Gaza into Egypt, given the horrendous conditions there. And if Israel takes over the Rafah border crossing with Egypt, I think that exacerbates those concerns. You've had Egypt make statements to the effect of that not being something that can happen as far as they are concerned. So you have the role of the mediators. Perhaps What Netanyahu is hoping is that he can get some of the hostages out, because there is pressure, without having to concede on the other issues. So perhaps they're hoping that phase one happens. I don't think it's going to happen at that low cost. What the Americans seem to hope is that they can drive a wedge between Netanyahu, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, and that Netanyahu, if faced with the opportunity, for instance, of a deal with Saudi Arabia, will not be able to stand down public pressure. I think this is more American naivety, American failure to learn the lessons of history, because I think Netanyahu will turn around and say, I can get a better deal, maybe not now, maybe not with this president, but look, I got those Abraham Accord deals while giving nothing, and I'll get something this time. So again, what does it boil down to? It boils down to whether this administration, this president actually wants to create circumstances in which Israel has hard choices to make, in which genuine American